Well, welcome this morning, and what we're going to be looking at this morning is probably one of the best or most well-known passages of the Word, which has to do with the Lord's betrayal and subsequent arrest. And today, so the focus today shifts over onto the character of Judas. And today's sermon is about finding the Judas within us all. But who was the person of Judas? Well, we know that Judas was one of the Lord's disciples, that he was chosen by the Lord to be one of the 12. And in terms of his life with the Lord, he is most well known or infamous for his part in the arrest of Jesus. We will see that he is described as a thief. And he is also, or was, the holder of the purse. He held the money that came into that group of disciples, and so was able also to distribute it. But Judas presents us with some perplexing questions. For he was needed in the drama of the Lord's life in order that the scriptures be fulfilled. Did Jesus specifically choose him for this task, knowing full well that he would hand the Son of Man over to his enemies? And why, over the time that Judas was with Jesus, do we not have any indication of whether the Lord did anything to prevent Judas acting as he did? And what of the shock that the disciples would have had when Jesus told them that one of them would betray him? This was too much for them to bear, and they were understandably very disturbed. And their responses, as we shall see today, show as much. But their shock came from as much of a lack of understanding of the process. For the path, as far as the Lord was concerned, is set. Yet they continually refused to accept it. And perhaps there is something of an irony in that Jesus rebukes them on a number of times because they were unable to accept what the Lord was telling them concerning his going into Jerusalem. And that is embodied particularly in Peter. Peter, who one minute declared the Lord to be the Christ, and then when the Lord said to him that he would have to die, Peter stepped in and said, "Far be it that it should be so, Lord." And Jesus turned to him and spoke those words, "Satan, get behind me, for yours is not the things of God, but the things of men." And yet Judas is completely compliant with the process. And if anything, the Lord ensures that the opportunity presents itself for him, that is Judas, to do what he must do. There are mysterious things at work here. But the shock of discovery is the shock every disciple of the Lord must endure. For even Judas is representative of something within us all. This is our shock. We too have it in us to deliver the Lord into the hands of his enemies. And perhaps there is something in this, that in telling the disciples that one of them would hand him over, he is instructing us. One among you will deliver him into the hands of what is represented by the chief priests and the scribes within you. If you choose to walk the spiritual path, then, like the disciples, each of us will struggle to understand this. We will struggle to accept it. We are resistant to it because we can't imagine what this Judas could be within us. So at the beginning of this chapter, in verse 1, the chief priests are described as seeking a way in which they might take him and kill him. And then in verse 10, the means by which this could occur presents itself. And we'll be looking at that today. Let us pray. A reading from the Word from the Old Testament is actually from Exodus this morning. Chapter 12, verses 1 through 17. Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, "This month shall be your beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the tenth of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb according to the house of his father, a lamb for a household. And if the household is too small for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next to his house take it according to the number of the persons. According to each man's need, you shall make your count for the lamb. Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. Now you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at twilight. And they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses where they eat it. Then they shall eat the flesh on that night, roasted in fire, with unleavened bread, and with bitter herbs they shall eat it. Do not eat it raw, nor boiled, at all with water, but roasted in fire, its head with its legs and its entrails. You shall let none of it remain until morning, and what remains of it until morning you shall burn with fire. And thus you shall eat it, with the belt on your waist, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. So you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. For I will pass through the land of Egypt on that night, and will strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. Now the blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and the plague shall not be on you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. So this day shall be to you a memorial, and you shall keep it as a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. You shall keep it as a feast by an everlasting ordinance. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall remove leaven from your houses. For whoever eats leavened bread from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. And on the first day there shall be a holy convocation, and on the seventh day there shall be a holy convocation for you. No manner of work shall be done on them, but that which everyone must eat, that only may you prepare. So you shall observe the feast of unleavened bread, for on this same day I will have brought your armies out of the land of Egypt. Therefore you shall observe this day throughout your generations as an everlasting ordinance. From the Gospel of Mark, chapter 14, verses 10 to 21. Then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priests to betray him to them. And when they heard it, they were glad and promised to give him money. So he sought how he might conveniently betray him. Now on the first day of unleavened bread, when they killed the Passover lamb, his disciples said to him, "Where do you want us to go and prepare that you may eat the Passover?" And he sent out two of his disciples and said to them, "Go into the city, and a man will meet you carrying a pitcher of water. Follow him. Wherever he goes in, say to the master of the house, 'The teacher says, where is the guest room in which I may eat the Passover with my disciples?' Then he will show you a large upper room, furnished and prepared. There, make ready for us." So his disciples went out and came into the city and found it just as he had said to them, and they prepared the Passover. In the evening he came with the 12. Now as they sat and ate, Jesus said, "Assuredly, I say to you, one of you who eats with me will betray me." And they began to be sorrowful and to say to him one by one, "Is it I?" And another said, "Is it I?" He answered and said to them, "It is the one of the 12 who dips with me in the dish. The Son of Man indeed goes just as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been good for that man if he had never been born." And the reading from the Heavenly Doctrines is from the Arcana Celestia, paragraph 10, 1210. A lamb signifies the good of innocence in the internal man, and innocence must be present if truth and good are to be received. The good of innocence consists in acknowledging that all truths and forms of good come from the Lord, and none at all from the human self or proprium. Thus it consists in wishing to be led by the Lord and not by self. For this is evident, that the more a person trusts and believes in himself, thus the more he is ruled by self-love, the less the good of innocence is present in him. This is why a person cannot be purified from evils unless the good of innocence is present in him. For if this good is not present, that person is led not by the Lord, but by self. And anyone who is led by self is led by hell, since the human proprium is nothing but evil, and all evil belongs to hell. Last week we read about the situation with the woman with the spikenard and the alabaster who anointed Jesus, and how those who were around her, or some of those around her at least, struggled with this, seeing it as a waste. And we saw how that often when the focus is on external things can seem to be of little significance. But of course Jesus put the record straight, saying that what she did would be remembered wherever the gospel was preached. But those who complained, we get an interesting insight into the situation in John's gospel in chapter 12. And just reading verses 4 and 5, we see this. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, who would betray him, said, why was this fragrant oil not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor? This he said, not because he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and had the money box, and he used to take what was put in it. So there we have an insight, perhaps concerning something of the nature of Judas. And we see that from John's Gospel that it was after this event with the spikenard that Judas is seen to make his move, to move towards the chief priests and the scribes in order to hand the Lord over, or at least to bargain with them initially, to arrive at a plan whereby the Lord would be handed over to his enemies. So what does Judas represent within us? Well, certainly from that passage in John, we get real insight into something of the motive at work. And we learn there that Judas is a thief. Now, a thief lays claim to that of another and calls it his own. So we don't have to go far. All we need to do is ask the question that, do we have anything within us that claims merit for what we do? Do we see ourselves as good people, as people that are honest and upright? Most of us have such a view of ourselves. Certainly in an external sense, we would see ourselves as law-abiding citizens, as good people, as honest and upright people. But the whole process of spiritual growth and development, the whole process of repentance, is not to focus on those things outside of us, but to focus on what it is that is operating within us. And if we honestly reflect on those things that pass through our thoughts and our affections, then we will see that we are indeed a mix. And if we believe that external view of ourselves without reflecting on what is internal, then we become a thief. You see, when we start to reflect on our inner nature, on the world of our thoughts and feelings, on the world of our motives, a very different picture to that external view of ourselves begins to emerge. And it is necessary that if we are to grow, that these two pictures come together within our consciousness so that we can see that things aren't what they appear to be. Every day, we have uncharitable thoughts. Every day, there will be moments of anger that rise within you, but that you successfully suppress. And there will be times when you can't suppress it. It just comes out. Every day, we are in contact with people who disturb and annoy us. Every day we act in one way, in one situation, with those perhaps we're not so close to, and act very differently with those we are close to. And the problem is that we don't often see the contradictions that exist in terms of our view of ourselves, and the way we even do behave externally. And if we understand that we should be reflecting on our motives with the truths that we are learning from the Lord's Word, but don't do it, then we make excuses and we rationalize things and we nullify the effect that the word of the Lord can have in our lives for good. And the nullification of the impact of the word in our life is spiritual theft. It is the Judas principle in us operating, not allowing those things that are good and true to influence our life, but rather remaining in our selfishness and thereby handing those things over to the chief priests and the scribes. I'm just going to read from the Arcana. There's a few passages here, but they all have to do with the idea of the thief. From John 10, Jesus says this, "Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter by the door into the sheepfold, but climbs in by another way, that man is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. I am the door. If anyone enters through me, he will be saved, and will go in, and will go out, and will find pasture. The thief does not come except to steal, and to kill, and to destroy. A thief in this instance also stands for the evil of merit seeking, for anyone who takes away from the Lord that which is his, and claims it as his own, is called a thief. This evil closes the path so as to prevent the flow of good and truth from the Lord, for which reason it is referred to as killing and destroying. Much the same is meant in the Ten Commandments, by you shall not steal. The sheep are those who have charity and consequently faith, and they enter the fold through the Lord when they acknowledge that he is the source of everything composing faith and charity. For then these flow in from him. But to attribute them to others, especially to self, is to take them away, which is to kill and destroy them. People who attribute entirely to themselves those things which are the Lord's also assume that merit lies in works and considers themselves righteous. This then is stealing in the spiritual sense. There is also this law: if there is found a man who has stolen a soul from his brothers, from the children of Israel, and has made profit on him and has sold him, that thief shall be killed, so that you remove evil from the midst of you. Those who steal the children of Israel stands for those who acquire the truths of the church, not with the intention of living according to them and thus teaching them from their hearts, but with the intention of using those truths for personal profit. The damnation of such a person is meant by he shall be killed." Judas was a keeper of the purse. Now money in the natural world is what knowledge is in a spiritual world. And what we see with this theft as the keeper of the purse, that Judas represents that which would use knowledge in self-interest. It uses it for self rather than for spiritual growth and development, for the cultivation of a genuine concern for the spiritual well-being of others. Rather than that, it seeks worldly ends. It uses the knowledge to acquire the world and satisfy the loves of self and the world. You see, our reasoning faculties are given to us in order that we might move from being self-centered to being centered on the Lord, or having that genuine concern for the spiritual well-being of others, permeating our whole being. But where these things are neglected and the self is made the center, then all the knowledge that comes to us is utilized in order to promote our own life. It is the promotion of self over others, and that, friends, is the operation of hell within us. You see, this is theft because it robs us, it robs our families, it robs those around us, it robs the Lord of our spiritual potential for doing good. And of course, it results in killing and destroying rather than lifting up and the giving of life. So we get some insight into the nature of this principle called Judas. But what about the name? Judas of Iscariot. Well, the Judas, the Iscariot. Well, Judas is the same word or the same name as Judah in the Old Testament. And Judah simply means prey. And so what of its connection with Judas? Well, where self-interest is at the centre of our lives, we have an insatiable appetite for the praise of others. We are constantly seeking it. We are constantly seeking to be affirmed by others. Because you see, when you're detached from the source of life, you need to be constantly convinced that the life that you have is in fact life itself. And the only way that can happen is if others keep telling you that, so that you can believe the appearance and not have to deal with those issues that come from the heart or the challenges that might come into our life when we feel a disconnection from life. And we use others to do this, to make us feel good, because we are disconnected from the source of goodness itself. Externally, Judas serves the Lord, but internally he's constantly looking to his own advantage. Thus he gives what is good and true over to the loves of self and the world. The surname is interesting, Iscariot, a man of Kirioth. Now Kirioth was a city of Moab. And the Moabites were descended from the incestual union between Lot and one of his daughters. And what the heavenly doctrines tell us is that Moab represents those who adulterate good, who mix it up with selfish motives in order to promote self-interest. In a more positive sense, it is that good which is easily seduced. And so that could apply here equally as well, as far as Judas is concerned. It also has this meaning, a man of hostile encounters. And this is the kicker. It also means man of conveniences. So Judas Iscariot stands between. He is the meeting point between those things that are genuine and those things that are evil and false. And in Judas, these things mix together. They come together. So he is the contact point. He is the place where good and truth is mixed with what is evil and false. And he is the connection between the Lord and the scribes and the chief priests talked about in this passage. So as a principle, Judas represents the full-blown nature of our ego. That ego or what is termed in the heavenly doctrines, the proprium of the human self that denies the divine. And we are all, at some level, attached to this. And it is from this that the Lord seeks to free us. Perhaps this is why the word for betray in the Greek actually means to deliver. There's two sides to it. Judas is our own selfishness. He is the destroyer of innocence. And he represents the very thing the Lord came into the world to deliver us from. And so this is what Judas is. And what we have is we have things going on at different levels. For while Judas is doing his deal with the chief priests and the scribes, Jesus is giving instructions at the request of the disciples. So there are different principles at work at different levels within us all the time. And we have to keep that in mind. This time is the time in which the Passover is to be killed. The disciples are oblivious to the reality that the true Passover is with them and is the Lord. And this represents our own state of ignorance as to how these things are played out within. And while we mightn't quite have the full picture, we know from those things that we have learnt from the Word and from the doctrines that we have a responsibility to work and to prepare our hearts and minds to be joined ever closer to those things that are good and true. To have our identity moved from what is represented by the proprium toward that which is represented by love to the Lord and love to our neighbour. And so it is that the disciples voice a question. And the question is the question we should be constantly asking ourselves. For here in the simple question is captured the attitude we need to bring to the Word, which is the Lord. Where do you want us to go and prepare that you might eat the Passover? It's about having an attitude of openness to the Word, that it can teach us and give us insights into how our lives may fall more and more into the order for which they were created, in order for us to become compassionate, more loving and understanding people. Where is it that you want us, Lord, to prepare this Passover? Now the Passover is a feast of remembrance. And we read about that in the Old Testament in that reading from the book of Exodus. And it celebrated the Israelite deliverance from Egyptian slavery. Now for 400 years, the sons of Israel were held in captivity and were made to serve the Egyptians. And so this feast was a Jewish celebration of their deliverance by the Lord. And this deliverance is captured here in these events that are occurring. For this is the fulfillment of that Old Testament feast, the Passover. And this deliverance is a picture, therefore, of our own deliverance. You see, the sons of Israel being slaves in Egypt, spiritually speaking, is when our spiritual ideas, or those things we pick up from the Word and the doctrines, enter into our life, or into our, at least into our memory, and we have knowledge of them, but we go on our merry way living our lives in a selfish way. Now, when those ideas are there, but have no impact on our life, then they are in slavery to those aspects of the world that we are seeking. They are made to serve us acquiring what we want. And that is what this picture of slavery in Egypt is all about. Serving worldly and selfish ends. And this is captured so well in the story of Judas, doing what he did for the promise of a reward for money. Remember, money, spiritually speaking, is knowledge. And so Judas is that principle which will take the knowledge, move into friendship with Jesus, involve himself with the disciples, but all the while looking to his own advantage. Egypt is a natural affection for knowledge, not a spiritual one. And it's knowledge for the reward that can be attained from the world and for self. And the silver promised to Judas is the false promise that comes with the temptation to instant gratification. And even long-term goals that are worldly can be considered instant gratification in an eternal picture as far as our lives go. To have spiritual knowledge and not use it for the purpose for which it was given is to hand over what is good and true to those lowest aspects of our nature. The Passover feast was centered around a lamb. And eating has to do with making what one is eating one with yourself, taking it in and making it one with yourself. And we read that the lamb represents innocence. And innocence is to do no harm. It is the essence of loving the Lord and loving our neighbour. And if we really do have a genuine concern for the spiritual well-being of others at the centre of our life, then we will not seek to do them any harm. Innocence comes about through being in the effort to have the word and this genuine concern for the spiritual well-being of others as the ruling principle in our life. If we are in the effort, it's not about reaching the goal, it's about being in the effort. If we are in the effort, we allow the Lord into our life to work what it is He must work, so that we can come closer to the goal of having that love at the center of our life. If we are in the effort, we can be delivered from the influences that selfishness has over us. We don't have to have it rule our lives, but we must make the effort to have the Lord in His Word at the center of our life. The Passover has two dimensions. Firstly, it is the strengthening of what is of the Lord in us. And secondly, it is the separation of those things that prevent that. This is true for us, and it is also true in a sense in terms of the Lord's own glorification. You see, Judas is that which served him for a time. But now it must be completely separated from him. And it represents the human heredity that the Lord took from Mary to be born into this world. And it is that which he put off, that the human principle from the Lord may be made fully divine. So one level we have the glorification of the Lord being spoken about. And at another level we have our own regeneration. But we must be in the effort. And that effort is what the preparation is all about. So it is we have that teaching from verses 13 to 21, where the Lord talks about, or indeed does, sends two disciples, and then talks about what it is they will find. And so we speak of this higher level. So the Judas stuff is going on down here, but at a deeper level, the Lord is working to put us into a position whereby we can go through what is about to come, which is the Lord's betrayal, arrest, and death. And so how is it we are prepared? Well, firstly, two disciples are selected. These two disciples are representative of all the disciples. And the reason two is used because it points to that, those two great commandments, love to the Lord and love to the neighbour. And what is it that these disciples have to do? Well, they have to go into a city. We've spoken many times about the fact that a city represents ideas that we are comfortable living in. And in this case, this city represents the body of knowledge and doctrine that has been built up in the disciples' time with the Lord. And what we're asked to do is to enter into that body of knowledge, which is at this time just purely knowledge, and to enter into it from the principles of loving the Lord and loving the neighbour. To go in there from that principle of a genuine concern for the spiritual well-being of others. And a love for the Word. And as we enter into our doctrine, into our city, from these principles, so what that city consists of can be reordered. Reordered so that all that knowledge can be put to use. This is what the Lord requires of us. And so we see that the Lord says to his disciples, as they enter into that city, they will find a man. Or they will find what is truly human. What is human? What is merciful? What is compassionate? What is full of understanding within that body of knowledge that we have built up? For to be truly human is to partake of those qualities of the Lord and to have them expressed through us as his servants. And so as we approach the Word and the doctrine, the teachings that we have from that principle of love, from that perspective, then they find their place within each and every one of us as healing balm for all those we come into contact with. What a truly great vision. And what is it about this man? Well, Jesus says to his disciples that they will find that he's carrying a water pot. And so what happens is we see that love draws out what is true and is connected with what is human. So the truths are carried by what is truly human. For water is spiritually truth. And it is that truth that cleanses and purifies or is able to quench our thirst for meaning. It is that truth which teaches us how to love more effectively, more compassionately, and with greater understanding. And what is it that that truth will do? Well, if we follow it, we will be led to a house. And of course, a house corresponds to goodness. And so it is that as we enter into that city, looking from that motivation of love to the Lord and love to our neighbor, and we find that which is truly human, we find that truth, and we, with everything in our being, follow it, we are led to a house in the midst of the city, and that house is the goodness within the truth that we have. Is the goodness that comes from living from what is heavenly within our lives. And what happens next is this, that we are confronted with the good man of the house. And of course, the good man or the good human is the Lord himself. And so it is that we come to see the Lord in the center of our life. It is being led by love and having that as the ruling principle in our life that we are brought to the Lord Himself. And from this level of understanding, this new insight that's coming, the good man of the house will direct us and show us those states within which conjunction or a closer union with the Lord can take place. When we come to that place, so we see that a question is to be asked. And the question has to do with where is the room, the guest room, where I might eat Passover with my disciples. And this asking of the question has to do with investigation. So it has to do with bringing the truth that we know and inquiring of the Word, where is the guest room? Where is that space, that sacred space within which a truly closer union with the things of love can be established within our life? Where is the guest room? Do we truly seek it? Do we inquire of the Word as to the states of our own life? Do we seek it with all of our heart? For you see, this is the sacred space in which the Lord can be released. For in the Greek, that term guest room has to do with an inn, if you like, or where one can drop one's load and get rest. And so that the literal meaning of the word for guest room is to be down loose. And so what we see here is an inquiry into that place where the Lord can be down loosed or released into our life. And surely this is the goal of every true spiritual path, to have the things of love released in our midst, brought down to the reality of daily living. To have the Lord released amongst us. And when this is our goal, so we will be shown an upper room, a higher place from which to live, a more internal space from which love can come forth. And this upper room in the Greek means literally upland. The higher ground of being that we should all be seeking to find. And what we find is that it is ready, finished, and prepared. What a powerful, powerful message that is. A powerful truth. For while we struggle with the lower things, and while we are in the effort, so something is going on at a deeper level. As we follow the Lord, as we struggle with these things, as we struggle on the spiritual path, be sure of this. Even though you cannot see it, something's going on at a deeper level. You see, as we follow the Lord in His Word, so things are being established, furnished, prepared in the inner realms of our being. And we are to be brought to these things when that work has reached the necessary level of fulfillment in the external areas of our life. At that higher level, we mightn't see it, but we can take heart that the Lord is at work and He has gone ahead and He is preparing the way. It is only as we get to that place that we are truly prepared for the next insight described here. For the Lord has to prepare us to a level internally before we can be ready to face the prospect of the Judas within. For when those things at a deeper level are established, so it is that the insight into the nature and activity of our own Judas can be revealed. For now we see that the Lord reveals it to His disciples, and it comes down on them like a hammer, as it will on us, if we can receive it. Because you see, this revelation, or this insight that comes concerning our lower nature, truly strikes to the heart of our own view of ourselves. It smashes this. That view of being an honest and upright person. Whereas internally, it's a very different situation if we would care to reflect. And so once the internals are established and the ground and foundation is set, so this insight comes as to the nature of those lower aspects within ourselves. And there is a Judas there. And the revelation is given in order that we might go within and that we might reflect on what is within. We can see this, for the disciples' response was, "Is it I, Lord?" is this deep soul searching, trying to seek it out. What is it in us that would seek to betray the Lord? Is it I, Lord? Or if you like, is it ego, Lord? Is it the proprium, Lord? Is it our selfishness, Lord? For the word used for I is the Greek word ego. And it directs us to that sense of self built around lower things. And we can be sure that the answer is yes. For you see, Judas is described as the one of the 12. That's what the Greek actually says. The one of the 12. And in this context, he represents something that permeates the 12. Because while he is in their midst, the whole is corrupt. And this is why this process is going on here. It is so that Judas can be separated from the other disciples and from the Lord. So that those lower things within us that are full of self-interest and self-centeredness can be separated out. For once he is separated out, then the whole becomes purified. But while the principle has a place of dominance within our lives, it infects the whole, and so it must be cast out. And this is the mystery of the Feast of the Unleavened. Remember, that is the feast here, along with that of the Passover. For this feast symbolized the removal of those things which obstructed the Lord's presence. It is the removal of what is evil and false, those things tied to our selfishness. Is it I? Is it ego? It is this that hands the Lord over. And none of us are immune. Amen.